Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Tomorrow, the government shutdown will enter its third week, making it the longest shutdown in U.S. history. According to some headlines, the shutdown is a partisan issue, with both Democrats and Republicans prolonging it. But we are also seeing more coverage of government workers who are living paycheck to paycheck. Because 800,000 workers will not receive a paycheck today, many do not know how they will pay for rent, food, and other necessities. According to Good Jobs Nation, the federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers. Yesterday, government employees and unions took part in rallies outside of federal buildings across the United States. Joining us to discuss coverage of the shutdown is David Dayan, a contributor to The Intercept and The New Republic and award-winning author of Chain of Title, which tells the story of three ordinary Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Arthur Delaney is senior reporter at the Huffington Post covering politics and the economy. And later in the show, we will speak with Arthur about the 38 million people who are on food stamps. Hi, Arthur. Arthur, thank you for coming on and welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on the Media Roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Arthur, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Trip Gabriel's New York Times story about Steve King had a remarkable impact because there have been a lot of stories documenting his many racist statements. But for this story, Gabriel got King to repeat some of those, and all of a sudden it's got several Republican colleagues of King's saying that he's unacceptable, and conservative media figures saying that he's unacceptable. So even though it was sort of reiterating things that were already out there and that Huffington Post has put out there a lot of times, it had this big impact, and that's commendable.
And he's the congressman from Iowa, right?
Yes, and he was saying, I don't understand why white supremacy and white nationalism are offensive terms all of a sudden.
Mm.
And so everyone is like, well, you know, American history, Steve King. And, you know, that's just, he's got such a long history of saying offensive things, racist things about minorities in the U.S., and it's brought it all to head very effectively.
Can you elaborate on that? He said, for people who haven't been following this, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did this language become offensive? Why did I sit in classes teaching me about the merits of our history and our civilization?
So he's pretending to be naive, to play dumb about the fact that those terms, you know, talking about the decline of Western civilization, the Great Replacement of Western civilization with other people's babies. He's acting like these aren't white nationalist buzzwords. And he should know better by now because people have been telling him since last year. He says things like, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus only exists to give special rights to African Americans. He acts like there has been no U.S. history, that we just arrived here and there weren't centuries of slavery and exploitation and segregation. And he's saying, why can't I just say nice things about white people, you know, with no context whatsoever? Sure, say nice things about white people, but we're talking about America, and in the context of this being America, what you're doing is espousing white supremacy. He just refuses to admit that, and people are now clamoring louder than ever for him to cut it out, or to at least admit that this is the society we live in.
Mm. So that's a piece by Trip Gabriel of the New York Times called Before Trump, Steve King Set the Agenda for the Wall and Anti-Immigrant Policies. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. That's Arthur Delaney, senior reporter with the Huffington Post. What about you, David? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, there's been a lot of great reporting about the shutdown, but I assume we're going to be talking about that afterwards. So I'm going to mention Alex Koch's piece about John Kyle. Now, John Kyle, this is in Sludge, which is an independent reporting outlet that does work on money and politics. Kyle is, he was a senator for three terms. He left in 2012. He immediately went to Covington & Burling, a high-powered lobbying firm, had dozens of lobbying clients. When John McCain passed away, Kyle replaced him for just 3 months. He was a senator from Arizona. He replaced him for 4 months, from September to December, seemingly to just refresh his lobbying contacts. And then 7 days after he resigned on December 31st, he went back to Covington & Burling. And I've written about this, but Koch advances the story by showing that Kyle actually not only voted for, but advocated for increasing nuclear weapons in multiple contexts, floor speeches, op-eds in the Washington Post while he was a senator. And his financial disclosure showed that he was taking payments as a member of the board of a nuclear weapons company and was also a lobbyist for two defense contractors who would benefit from expanding the nuclear output. So it's, you know, just one of those stories. It's kind of been under the radar because, you know, I guess all we hear about is Trump. But it's one of the more fascinating stories of public corruption, I think, in the last recent memory. This guy who just keeps going back and forth from Congress to this lobbying firm and is seemingly doing it with impunity.
Wow. Well, yeah, and the question is this unique? Because I think it was The Hill, they had a piece recently about other members of Congress who lost their races who are now going to go work for lobbying firms.
I mean, it's certainly not unique to see members of Congress go to K Street after they lose.
Right.
What's unique in this case is that John Kyle became a temp senator in between lobbying gigs. We've almost never seen this because he was not replaced because of an election. He just said, I'm only going to be a senator for 4 months. And it just seems very clear that he was just sort of refreshing his Rolodex and his knowledge of his you know, senatorial colleagues and the executive branch, and now can ask for even more money in the private sector as a lobbyist.
Hmm. Wow. Well, thank you for that one. Thank you for a non-Trump story. John Kyle voted for new nukes after taking payments from nuclear company. The senator turned lobbyist turned senator turned lobbyist, had a paid board seat at one nuclear company and lobbied for two others. Then he joined the Senate. And this is all legal, right, David? I mean, this is legal corruption, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a case where the scandal is what's legal.
Right.
Kyle, as I've reported, you know, under the Lobbying Disclosure Act, you're supposed to list your clients, and he actually, in his financial disclosure, did not list nine clients, citing a D.C. bar rule, basically attorney-client privilege, to you know, block a federal financial disclosure. So while we know about these nuclear clients, we don't know the names of several of the clients he had at Covington & Burling before joining the Senate, who he could now be working for after joining the, leaving the Senate.
And this is the kind of piece where a reporter really needs to spend some time digging deep, right, in order to find all of these connections.
Yeah, I mean, this is a situation where there are federal disclosures. Kyle waited until after he left Congress to file his financial disclosure, which was supposed to be about conflicts of interest for him in the Senate, but he was gone from the Senate by the time he had filed it. So, you know, you need to be able to locate that stuff and make the connections and then figure out, you know, what he's actually arguing, if he wants to keep something secret and things like that. So it does require some pretty deep work and familiarity with these kind of issues.
Arthur, is there anything you want to add about what it takes to uncover what we call legal corruption in the United States?
The most important thing is that it takes a willingness on the reporter's part to be a pain and not accept that this is just the way things are done, so you're not supposed to fuss about it. But go ahead and look at not only the letter of the law, you know, of course it is supposed to be illegal to just dash back and forth between K Street and a congressional seat, but it's totally contrary to the spirit of the law, and you have to be willing to be a pain and make people roll their eyes to do that story.
Well, thanks to Alex Koch of Reed Sludge. I've never heard of this one, and thank you, David, for bringing it to our attention, and we'll put this at yourcallradio.org. David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and author of a great book, Chain of Title, which tells the story of three Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post covering politics and the economy. Let's dive in now and talk about the government shutdown. 800,000 workers are not going to receive a paycheck today. Today is payday. So many people do not know how they will pay for their rent, their food, and other necessities. And we're now seeing a lot of stories about this. And I just want to ask you both generally, what stands out for you? One of the headlines that stood out for me is the Washington Post had a piece, Coast Guard families told they can have garage sales to cope with government shutdown. Bankruptcy is a last option, the service said in a tip sheet published on the web on a website. So a five-page tip sheet published by the Coast Guard Support Program is basically encouraging people to have garage sales to make ends meet. I mean, Arthur, has this happened in the past where people were told to have bake sales and garage sales?
I don't know if it has been. It kind of goes without saying that you could do that, right? Like, I guess that some manager was trying to be nice, but, like, I think people will realize if they're starving that maybe they should sell items in their house while they can't work. You know, my colleague Dave Jameson did a good story about how there's a spike in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia of federal workers applying for unemployment insurance, which is a little weird because they're not exactly unemployed and they may have to pay the benefits back if they ultimately receive back pay. But it's great to focus on the ways that something abstract like government shutdown causes immediate material hardship to almost a million people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the larger point here is one about our economy and the sort of precarious way in which so many people live their lives. It's just the case that there aren't that many people out there that have a big store of savings so that they can plan and you know, make contingencies in the event that they miss a paycheck. The Senate just yesterday passed by voice vote a guarantee for federal workers, actual employees of the federal government, that they will get back pay when the shutdown ends. However, that doesn't help their immediate cash flow problem, which they have to make up for by themselves. And we just don't have an economy that people can cope and have, at least people in the working class can have the kind of savings that are available to them so that missing a paycheck isn't a major hardship.
Right. And also, to add to that, the number of people living paycheck to paycheck is massive in this country. A recent report from the Federal Reserve revealed how little cushion most people have in their budgets. 4 in 10 people say they cannot come up with $400 if they had some kind of emergency. And David, we're going to talk about contract workers, but I'm guessing that a lot of people until now did not realize that the federal government is the largest employer of low-wage workers. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's correct. So, you have to make a distinction between federal employees who get their paycheck signed by the federal government department that they work for and federal contract workers. And when you're talking about the low-wage sector, you're talking about, you know, people who do the janitorial services at federal buildings or people who work in retail or guest services at the Smithsonian Museums or the National Zoo or people who do security at those buildings. Those are usually paid by a contractor who gets money from the federal government and then pays it out, unlike federal workers who usually, and the Senate just passed, get back pay for the days that they are furloughed. These contract workers do not. And they are the lowest paid members of sort of the federal government sector. I talked to one, a guy who's a greeter at the National Zoo, and he makes $13.50 an hour. And he's not getting paid right now because the National Zoo is closed, and it's highly unlikely that he will get any back pay for that. So he's just missing work, and this is a single guy who doesn't really have any family, and he's worried about whether he's going to be able to pay his bills. And, you know, as you say, it, when we don't have a cushion, you don't have a safety net for people, where people can't, you know, get their hands on $400 in emergency, missing that one paycheck is a huge problem. And, there simply are lots, because the government is so big, there simply are lots of low-wage workers in government, and they're all experiencing those problems, and it's really kind of tragic that those who are paid the least are probably hurt the most in the aftermath of a government shutdown.
David, do you know when did or who decided that the U.S. government would employ so many contractors? Why was that decision made?
Right. So now you have to go back to the 1980s and talk about the Reagan Revolution, which included privatization, which took a lot of jobs that were being done by government employees and said, well, the government is inefficient and private enterprise can do this cheaper and more efficiently, and so we're going to outsource all of these various functions to the private sector, and we're going to pay them a contract, and then they can figure out how to deal with their employees. And we've seen this grow and grow. It really started in the Reagan administration, which actually did a published report about privatization, I believe in 81 or 82, and it continued through the reinventing government phase of Bill Clinton, and certainly in the George W. Bush administration, and on and on. And now I think that the figure is that 4 out of every 10 workers who get paid by the federal government are private contractors or contract workers. So it's really expanded, and this whole problem with the shutdown is a function of privatization. It's not the only problem with privatization, but it's one of those that these workers are really operating without a net.
So, Arthur, what would it take to ensure that these contract workers actually become full-time workers? Because can we also assume that these contract workers don't have any benefits? Do you know, Arthur?
It's likely that they don't. I mean, that's one of the whole reasons for contracting, that you get that whole problem off your plate of providing benefits, and then you let other companies bid for the right to get this contract, and a lower bid will get it, and the bid will be lower because the workers employed by the company are paid less, and they're not given benefits. This is something that happens in the broader economy too. Economists debate how much it's happening, but this is the whole point of outsourcing and privatization. It costs less money because the workers are screwed.
Right.
I can tell you that the worker I spoke to works for the National Zoo, gets paid vacation and sick leave, but does not get health benefits. In fact, he's on Medicaid. He's allowed to use his vacation time to actually get paid during this shutdown. But of course, then he wouldn't have any vacation time for the rest of the year.
Bloomberg reports that if recent history is any guide, federal contractors could be out more than $200 million a day in lost or delayed revenue from the government shutdown. David, is there any effort on the part of any politician in Washington to ensure that these contractors become workers? I mean, you wrote about this for, mm-hmm. in the New Republic. You know, where are the Democrats, these new progressive Democrats, where are they in standing up for low-wage government workers?
Well, I am happy to say that there has been some movement in the last week. Ayanna Pressley, who's one of those new freshman House Democrats who came in on the progressive side, she beat an incumbent, has called for the restitution for low-wage contract workers. On the Senate side, Tina Smith, who's a senator from Minnesota, has a bill in the works with six other colleagues that would give back pay to these workers. But you'll note that when the Senate passed by voice vote this a guarantee for back pay when the shutdown ends, that only applied to federal workers, not to federal contract workers. And so while there has been some movement in the last week or so, it's still not at the point where the House or Senate is passing anything to help these federal contract workers who, as I said, once again, are probably the least equipped within the federal government to handle missing weeks of pay.
David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and The New Republic. You can find his piece, Why Aren't Democrats Standing Up for Low-Wage Government Workers, at yourcallradio.org. He's also award-winning author of Chain of Title. We're also joined by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at The Huffington Post, covering politics and the economy. Arthur, it seems like, okay, now that the media, from The Guardian to The Times, NPR Morning Edition, I mean, Democracy Now! Has been covering this nonstop, they're doing a good job of talking to workers, giving them a voice about how difficult it is to make their mortgage, pay their rent, feed their families, car payments, all of that. But what about the bigger story here? It seems like now is a really good time to ask this question. Why is it that so many government workers are contractors and paid a very low wage? I mean, you know, depending on where you live, David interviewed a guy in D.C. It's very expensive there. You cannot live there on a $12 to $15 hour wage. So are you seeing those bigger picture stories?
No. You have to break a pretty firm consensus that a little bit of privatization is good. And I think that's something that could happen in the coming years as there's more and more Democrats with bigger and bigger ideas. But the fact that Democrats aren't already doing it is, I think, testament to how basic of an assumption it is that there's just going to be a bunch of contractors all the time. Mm. So it's and with so many other things being debated right this minute, it seems like it's not, you know, aside from pieces of legislation that will not get, you know, a lot of support, it's something that will be left out for the time being. Even though government contract workers have been at the forefront of the fight for 15 and have done all kinds of strikes in recent years, it's curious, but it does seem like they're left out of the agenda.
What would you add, David?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. That is what motivated me to write about this issue in The New Republic, because you don't have to go too far back. In 2013, there was a 17-day shutdown, and just like normal, these contract workers did not receive any kind of back pay, and it had lingering effects. I mean, you're talking about people losing homes, losing, you know, being unable to make rent, having problems with, you know, even something as like Christmas presents or being able to pay their utilities. It's a shock to the system, and you know, it's not an accident or in terms of how to get this on the radar screen that these contract workers are centralized, not all of them, but most of them, in Washington D.C. which has a representative, Eleanor Holmes Norton, but that representative doesn't have an actual vote in Congress. Mm. And so it's you know, even harder for these workers who are, you know, who have their constituents of a member of Congress who is muted because they don't have a vote.
And David, I know we have to let you go. One last quick question. In your piece, you wrote that thanks to an executive order from Barack Obama in 2014, the minimum wage for federal contract employees was boosted to $10.35. Again, right, not enough to make ends meet anywhere in the country. But under Obama, did the Democrats do anything to ensure that more people became full-time workers rather than contractors?
No, I would say not. I would say the trends of privatization and they pretty much continued throughout the Obama administration. There was no great pushback to put some people back, you know, on the federal workforce. You certainly saw, you know, one of the largest government agencies, the U.S. Postal Service, in terms of workers, you saw layoffs and cuts to their workforce. So, this is not, you know, the larger step of privatization is not something that has really been challenged This first step of back pay for these low-wage contract workers at least is starting to get into the conversation, but no one's made that leap to why this situation exists, and the answer is privatization.
Hmm. Well, thank you for writing this piece because it's such an important angle. David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and The New Republic. His piece, Why Aren't Democrats Standing Up for Low-Wage Government Workers? David is the author of Chain of Title, which tells the story of three Americans who uncovered Wall Street's foreclosure fraud. David, thanks again for your work and thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at The Huffington Post, where he covers politics and the economy. And we will speak with Arthur about the latest piece he wrote about food stamps. 38 million people are on food stamps. What is in store for the people who rely on food stamps to buy food for their families? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW. Better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. More on Mike Pompeo's visit to the Middle East and Kim Jong-un's trip to China. That and more on the way for 1A at 11. Stay with us.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covers politics and the economy. Arthur, before we dive in and talk about your reporting on food stamps, one of your latest pieces is called Senate Republicans Won't Fund the Government If It Means Defying Trump. They're just not feeling the whole co-equal branch of government thing. And I just wanted to ask you how the media are covering the shutdown and their, you know, some obsession with kind of that balance thing going on, because according to some headlines, the shutdown is a partisan issue with both Democrats and Republicans prolonging it. The AP got a lot of criticism on Twitter for putting out a headline, Democrats put the blame for the shutdown on Trump, but it takes two to tango. Trump's demand for $5 billion for his border wall is one reason for the budget impasse. The Democrats' refusal to approve the money is another. What are your thoughts on that?
It speaks to the way Trump has basically hacked the media and how that has benefited him, because there's a natural tendency among journalists to want to be fair and look at what the other side's doing wrong when it's even when it's really obvious who is causing things to happen. In this instance, Donald Trump said, "Give me $5 billion for a wall," and Democrats have not negotiated. But why would Democrats negotiate? Now, there was no offer made to Democrats from Trump that would be compelling to them. And Trump himself said, "I will shut down I'm happy to shut down the government. Let's do it." And then it happened, and it really is that simple. This is what Donald Trump wanted. He's doing it, and Republicans are totally backing him up. And that's why the government's been shut down for 3 weeks.
The other thing, we talked about this last week, but what about the stories about the fact that the wall has already been the border has already been so militarized? I mean, since 9/11, billions of dollars has been spent militarizing the border. What about that piece of this story?
Oh, the whole situation of the border is so slippery when it's part of the policy debate. You know, the first thing to know is that there already are, a third of the border already does have, like, some fence. And Donald Trump, what he wanted was a giant concrete wall along the whole 2,000-mile range of the border. And then he's saying, well, you know, now I don't want a wall. I want steel slats, which is, you know, what we would probably use the word fence to describe. And Democrats are saying, well, we're against a wall, but we would support a smart wall, or we would support drones. and more people with better gadgets to scan border crossers or people coming through ports of entry. So it gets really slippery when you try to drill down to what they're actually talking to. And Trump has benefited from that. Mm. The vagaries of the supposed vagaries of what he wants. Republicans, you ask them about the $5 billion for a wall, and they say it's not for a wall, it's for a fence. Or they'll say it's not all for the wall, it's also for these other things, even though it's not. So there is ambiguity about the terms. And that has benefited Trump, but the thing he's doing is actually really simple. It's give me a unilateral policy concession. Just give it to me, even though my entire governing agenda was repudiated in the last election. And in the first election that I won, most people didn't vote for me anyway. So it's a more ridiculous situation than you would think from some of the headlines that are trying to be fair.
Hmm. And in the coming weeks, we're going to do a show just about what immigrants are facing as they travel north. I mean, we've done a lot of shows about that, but we're talking about, you know, actual people here. And the rhetoric that he's using is just so incredibly dangerous because, you know, we're talking about people, and he's using, I don't even like to repeat it, to tell you the truth, because it gets so much attention in the media on a regular basis.
It's worth talking about, though. You can read the testimony from the head of Customs and Border Patrol about what's going on at the border, and they say it's a humanitarian and security crisis, and Republicans are running with that. The people on the ground said it's a crisis. Well, it's a crisis because it's a humanitarian crisis because it's a bunch of women and children. It's families who are risking their lives to escape awful suffering in Central American countries, and it's not people who are terrorists who are going to come and kill you. But they're using the fact that Border Patrol said there's a crisis to say it's terrorists coming to kill you, and it's a totally false representation of what we're told is actually happening at the border, and it's not something that a wall is going to help at all.
Right. Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post, where he covers politics and the economy. And I want to spend some time talking about food stamps with you, Arthur. Before we talk about the politics of this, we're talking about 38 million people, and they depend on food stamps to feed their families. We're talking about $123 a month. Right?
Yes.
Okay.
And basically, the only big program, big government, federal or state or local, that is really responsive to economic need, food stamps, food assistance, SNAP. It's the most important federal program.
I think it's important to mention the amount, because in a lot of stories and conversations about food stamps, you don't hear that we're talking about $123 a month. And so if you let's say divide that by 30 days and then three meals, I mean, it's like $1.35 a meal.
That's right. That's the $125 is the per person amount. So, and the people are mostly children. But if you're say a mother or father and you've got a few kids, your benefit amount monthly will be a little bit more than, it'll be, you know, a few hundred dollars. But that's it for food. And like you said, that amounts to not very much per meal. So it does not pay the cost of feeding a family for a month. That's why they call it supplemental. They expect that you have other incomes, but some people don't.
Right. And so the money is deposited every month on a special EBT card. It kind of looks like a credit card, and that can be used in grocery stores for almost any food item. And as you said, this is one of the biggest U.S. safety net programs.
That's right. And if the shutdown goes on and on, it's just going to stop and there will be mass hunger. Now, the USDA did something pretty unusual, and they said, they looked at the law and they said, you know what, we're going to pay February's benefits. We're going to guarantee that those will go out. And they did that basically by using a loophole in the way the last government funding resolution was written, and states are going to have to scramble to get it done. But, you know, nobody, I've talked to members of Congress about this, nobody's complaining. People are glad that this will happen, and it looks like the state agencies that will actually have to carry out the electronic transfer should be able to do it. So that's a good thing. But if the shutdown goes on for months or years, like Donald Trump has said, it's going to be a real interesting policy experiment because people will, you know, millions of people will suddenly have no money for food.
Mm. 76% of SNAP benefits go to households with children. In 2013, recipients were 40% white, 26% black, 10% Hispanic. Can you talk, Arthur, you've followed this for so long, how has food stamp policies, how have they really changed over the years? First, let's talk about what has happened to food stamps before Trump.
There have not been a lot of dramatic changes. I mean, if you wanted to go way back, they used to be actual stamps that you would have to get out at checkout, but they've long since switched over to debit cards that are a lot more discreet, and you can buy any uncooked food product with it for you to make at home. So it allows people, even if you're very poor, to remain participate in commerce, basically, and go to the store and buy your food like everybody else. And Republicans have pushed to cut back on food stamp spending. They've pushed to add stricter work requirements. Right now, if you're a childless, non-disabled adult, in some states, you're expected to put in a certain number of hours of work. And this is really a bureaucratic requirement to kick that sort of person off benefits. And Republicans have not been very successful in making those rules more stringent. So SNAP, I would say, over the past couple decades, has been fairly steady, and that's how Democrats want to keep it. There was a big debate over this in the last Congress, and Democrats basically won that debate. Republicans decided they'd used most of their political capital on tax cuts for the rich, and they didn't want to have the big fight that they could have had on food benefits. And I think that the food benefits will basically be safe for the next 5 years, except for if there's a prolonged government shutdown. So it will be after February where we'll see if food benefits will be in serious trouble because of the shutdown, if it continues for that long.
Since you mentioned the work requirements, Arthur, what about the executive order that Trump signed last April to add work requirements for public assistance and other programs?
Oh, so a funny thing happened. They passed the bill that did not include the work requirements Republicans wanted. The House Republicans had this proposal to expand the work requirements to some people who are currently exempt, such as parents of children who are older than six and people in their 50s. And they couldn't get that through Congress because there are enough Democrats there to say no. So on the day President Trump signed that bill that did not include those proposals, Trump's USDA went ahead with a regulation that included some of the other stuff they wanted. So they basically went around Congress and issued this regulation that will make it more difficult for states to waive the requirements. We'll see, though, if that gets blocked in courts. It hasn't been implemented yet, but the Trump administration has gone ahead and they're seeing what they can do with the regulation, what they couldn't get through Congress. It really is the kind of thing that you would call executive overreach if you were so inclined. I know Republicans say that a lot.
And so the executive order is being challenged? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first there's a waiting period, and okay. Democrats, when they approved their rules for the chamber when they first took power this month, they included a provision saying we're going to have the lawyers to the House of Representatives look into doing whatever they can to challenge that rule. So while the Trump administration is being aggressive with this rule, it seems likely that it's going to get court challenges, and those court challenges could prevent it from taking effect.
I can't help but think about the $10 trillion in tax cuts that the Republicans passed. 20% go to the richest 1%. And here, 38 million people have to rely on $123 a month to feed themselves and their families. I mean, in order to buy healthy food, this is just impossible. Have there been efforts to increase this amount? And what would that take?
Jim McGovern is a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts who has gone on and on about how it's not an adequate amount of money for people to have a healthy diet. and that's going to go nowhere. Democrats, I don't think, want to have a fight over this program. They want to move on to other things. I think they're glad that they prevented more severe cuts in the legislation that passed. They're glad that the Trump administration has guaranteed benefits for February. So this is, I don't think they're going to be proactive. Like, they like to play defense on this program, but not offense. If you look at the Democratic candidates for president, they always talk about, you know, jobs guarantees or stipends to families with children or increasing tax credits, and they don't usually make a lot of noise about more generous food benefits, because they're just naturally inclined, it seems, to play only defense on that program.
Yeah, why is that? Because we're talking about 38 million people on this program.
It goes straight to the way politics in the U.S. is so racialized, and how race saturates everything that happens. We've done polling on this, and just the term food stamps in a majority of people makes them think of African Americans. Even though, like you were saying a minute ago, that's not who is primarily getting benefits from this program. And I think this dynamic causes Democrats to be less aggressive about the program, because they instinctively know, even though this is never or rarely spoken out loud, they instinctively know that that's the racial politics associated with this and pretty much every other welfare program except Social Security and Medicare, and so they prefer to talk about those and tax credits and not things that most voters will associate with African Americans.
You know, when we had David on, I mean, he wrote a piece, "Why Aren't Democrats Standing Up for Low-Wage Government Workers?" And he was talking about some of these new progressive, young, not all, members of Congress, all Democrats, a lot of people of color, and focusing on, are they going to stand up for these contract workers? So same question to you, Arthur. Do you think that these new progressive Democrats are going to start talking about poverty and about, I mean, middle-class poverty, what does that even mean anymore? When so many people cannot make ends meet, people who are working cannot make ends meet. Do you think that these new politicians are going to talk about food stamps and these social programs?
Well, they like to talk about the middle class. Like, Democrats generally love talking about the middle class. Republicans talk about the middle class. And they don't talk as much about poverty. And that's seems like the way it will remain, though we'll see with some of the Democratic presidential contenders who want attention for their potential future runs. Like, Sherrod Brown has some proposals that seem to target child poverty, and you can't do that without giving money to poor people and confronting all these racial subtexts more directly. So I think it could change, and it's possible that the incoming freshman Democrats in the House of Representatives will be a big part of that, but they've just started, and we haven't heard too much from them yet, just because it's so early.
Right. Today we're speaking with Arthur Delaney. He is a reporter at the Huffington Post, writing about politics and the economy, and right now we're talking about coverage of food stamps. 38 million people on food stamps. The average food stamp card, it's about $123 a month on it, which leaves you about $1.50 a meal. I mean, there's just no way anywhere in this country to get healthy food for that amount of money. Arthur, you know, the impacts of the shutdown on food stamps is such a local story. What are you seeing from local reporters who are covering this issue?
Local reporters do a great job covering this program. It was local reporters who were first writing about how it was possible there would be no benefits after January, and then the national media caught on, and shortly afterward USDA came out and said, we're going to guarantee February benefits. But it's still local reporters who are doing the most coverage of this. Like, every town that has a TV station or a newspaper at least nearby has got coverage of the possible threat to this program. At least as far as I can tell, if you just punch food stamps into Google, there's tons of local media stories. And I think it's a good example where they've got their priorities straight, because this is about people having money for food, and national media tends not to focus on that as much because it's, you know, they're more focused on the drama, the confrontation among members of Congress and the White House.
Right. Well, what do you think, since you brought up the upcoming presidential race, what do you think people can do to pressure media to actually focus on real issues? I've heard a few interviews with, you know, Kamala Harris has a new book out, and it's just really softball. You know, they ask about impeachment, when are you going to announce? But, you know, California has one of the highest poverty rates in the country. I hope that someone's going to ask her about that. But what can people do to pressure media to really dig into issues and not just these softball questions about, you know, impeaching Trump? I mean, it's an important question, but we need to know where they stand on issues.
Oh, well, you can. This is easy. You can yell at reporters on Twitter. If you hear an interview where you think they asked lame questions, you just yell at them on Twitter. I think reporters are amazingly accessible. There are very few who are not on Twitter and who are not like obsessively looking at their mentions. So I think it's probably easier than ever to yell at reporters. You yell at them on Twitter, and they'll probably see it. You know, if you're rude, they might mute you, and then they won't see it anymore. But you can yell at reporters on Twitter. I know people yell at me on Twitter, and I certainly notice it.
Yeah, because I hope that we actually, when a lot of Democrats are going to get into the ring, and I hope that the media focus on actual issues rather than the usual horse race coverage.
Well, like we were talking about how Democrats play defense on food benefits, I think that's starting to change more broadly. Like, Democrats are not just playing defense on other things with these Democratic contenders and people like Bernie Sanders making big proposals for things like expanding Medicare to everybody. I think we're starting to see that change.
Mm-hmm.
And it will definitely change more with the incoming freshman class in the House of Representatives that doesn't have all this old baggage. So I think that the debate will change, but if you're an individual news consumer and you wanted to urge it along, you just go ahead and get on Twitter and yell at your reporters there.
Well, right, because there's going to be, finally, for the first time ever, House Democrats are going to have a Medicare for All universal health care hearing, and Representative Pramila Jayapal is expected to come out with a bill in the coming weeks. So things are definitely moving in a different direction.
Yeah, and in 2018, there were a lot of big news outlets that treated this idea like it was really socialist or exotic or weird, and there have been also a lot of debunkings of that response, and I think it will be taken more seriously. It's not weird. It's what they have in, like, every other country, and by not having it here, there's unbelievably pointless material hardship inflicted on millions of people. And it's good that this will be taken seriously.
Right. No, it's so true. I, every time I meet someone from Europe, I always say, you know, where would a Bernie Sanders be in your country? And they say, yeah, he'd be pretty centrist here in
yeah,
the European country. I mean, it's...
there's all kinds of ridiculous things that we don't have, like guaranteed paid vacation. That's
right.
Totally normal in every other country. Paid family leave. Just totally the baseline in every other country that is comparable to the United States, and those countries are not hell holes. As a result, they're happy over there. It's a better way of doing things that saves money.
Right. We have an email from Catherine about contractors, and she says the contrast to contractor that Rose was looking for is employee, not full-time. Full-time or part-time is unconnected with contractor versus employee. By law, employees get FICA and some other legally mandated benefits like paid family leave and are protected by workplace safety standards. Most hourly employees are also eligible for overtime, but no benefits are required for contractors. A few highly skilled or unionized contractors do get benefits from the company that hires them out to clients. Thanks for a great show. Thank you, Catherine. No, that's important. And again, I just think it's so important to talk about this because it's we're finally learning that so many government employees are, or so many people who work for the government are contractors and cannot make ends meet. Like David said, he met a guy who's on Medi-Cal or Medicaid.
Yeah,
Medi-Cal's in California, Medicaid.
Yeah, you when you said employee earlier, you meant government employee as
right.
opposed to employee of some other firm that has a government contract. This is broader than just government contractors, though. there is a debate about how much this is happening, but certainly more than it used to, workers in the private sector are not actually employees of the company they obviously work for. Like, you're delivering packages for Amazon, but actually you work for LaserShip, and you have to take care of your own van, and you don't get health benefits, for example. Or you work for Uber, but you're not an Uber employee. You're a contractor, and you have to deal with your own car and pay for your own gas. So this is potentially a huge problem, and it's another thing that exposes the absurdity of our health insurance system, which is based on employer-employee relationships, and totally fails you if you're not a formal employee, because you don't get health insurance that way, and you have to rely on these like weird subsidies and things that were patched together in Obamacare that you wouldn't have to deal with if we just had national health insurance.
Well, hopefully that's the way it's going. Arthur, what are you working on right now?
Well, I've been covering the shutdown from the Capitol, and we've been talking to Republicans. I was asking Republicans all week, is Mexico going to pay for the wall? And it's weird because it's like a rude, trolly question on the one hand. On the other hand, it was the entire policy platform that Donald Trump won the presidency with, and Republicans can't handle the question. They'll say, well, the president says Mexico will pay, even though it makes no sense. So it's the story will attempt to get at what we're actually debating, and how far out into outer space is the actual policy debate that has caused the government to shut down and inflict suffering on millions of people.
Yeah, so what's the latest, just briefly? I mean, today it'll be the longest shutdown in history tomorrow, and people are not getting their paychecks today. How long do you think this will last?
There's no negotiating going on. Donald Trump said it could go on for years, but the smart money, which might be wrong, but this like clever idea that a lot of reporters have glommed onto, is that Donald Trump will declare a national emergency so that he can build the wall, which is, of course, weird and controversial, and then Republicans will say, okay, we can open the government because Trump is doing this unilaterally. And they know that he'll get tied up in court, and potentially no wall will be built that way, but then he'll be able to yell at the courts, and we'll all move on, and the government will reopen. So that's one scenario that we could see.
Arthur Delaney is senior reporter at the Huffington Post, covering politics and the economy. Arthur, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and David Latulip, who's our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar at Your Calls Media Roundtable.